We're trying to live with it, or hide from it more like. We've gotten good at it. Maybe we should never have gotten used to it. I don't know. But there were always hungry kids to feed and clothe. Seemed better to hide, not rock the boat. But that's me, not you. You're a smart kid. That little stunt at the lake proved it. You know that the ones really in charge don't bother with us because we're not worth the trouble. Living with the Padre, you probably know that more than most. It's only a matter of time before they get around to us. No matter how deep in the woods we go, it's them or us. Us meaning human beings. Getting rid of them is work for the cause.
David swallowed his food, but swallowing his mixed emotions was a much tougher proposition. Could he just take off? His vague plans for living in a lakeshore cabin in the company of books and fishing poles no longer applied or appealed ever since Samuels and Finner had mentioned killing the patrollers who had turned the only world he'd known into piles of butchered meat. Odd that this old neighbor spoke as though he were privy to secret, half-formed thoughts.
Are you saying I should leave? Join the resistance, take up the cause?
A few of the boys your age are. It happens every year. Folks are quiet about it. If word of a son or daughter leaving got to the patrols, there'd be trouble. So it's usually, Joe got married and is living with his wife's folks near Brainerd or some such. The councilmen discourage it, but Gaffley's own daughter ran away 2 years ago. Letters arrive every year, but he won't show them to anyone.
In a fit of contrariness, perhaps to show Quincy that he wasn't as astute a judge of human nature as the old man credited himself for being, David shrugged.
I can't say what I'll do, Mr. Quincy. I was thinking of going up to Lake of the Woods, building a boat. I love fishing, and they say next to no one lives there.
Sure, son. And maybe 20 years from now, a patrol will come through, just like...
Hey! That's not fair!
But it keeps happening. Just this spring out by Grand Rapids. 8 people, that one. The way I hear it, it's a lot worse down south. Especially in the cities, where there's nowhere to hide.
Valentine was about to say, "That's not my problem," but held his tongue. An orphaned 11-year-old had not been the Padre's problem that September afternoon so long ago, either. The Padre had faced the problem and took responsibility, because that is what decent people do.
Vampire Earth is continued on the next CD.
The wizard seemed a little surprised.
Usually I ask the questions, but I will do my best to answer yours. We are not any good at it. It would be like you defecating in your pants. You could do it if you put your mind to it, but you would not enjoy the experience. And until you had a chance to clean yourself, you would probably be preoccupied. We toilet trained ourselves far too long ago. We are not numerous, and my ability to change into a wolf does not mean I could bite like one. You Homo sapiens, on the other hand, are almost perfect killing machines. You are flexible, aggressive, intelligent, and inventive. We examined life forms on 12 worlds, and you half-savages revert to your terrible earlier selves with greater alacrity than any other. So we help you fight your battles. And in doing so, you fight our war for us. Or am I speaking in riddles again?
No, I understand. It's your method I question. Instead of arming us with some kind of advanced technology, you turn us feral. That seems a strange way to help us win a war.
Valentine was startled when the wizard abruptly disappeared, only to emerge from the dome-shaped cave's other exit, carrying what looked like a small mirror on a stand.
I am sorry. I had to get this, and I didn't want to interrupt, so I left you talking to an image. You said you understood, David. It is clear that you do not. I'm giving you the most powerful weapon on the planet, yourself, at your full potential.
I thought I was supposed to make up my mind.
You did, David. You did.
Amu again sat down opposite the young man.
The moment you thought of your father and his death, and wondered if he was the kind of man I want you to become. You may not have felt it, but to me, your fury was white hot. You can hide your rage from yourself, but not from me. It is so big, I wonder where you put it so you can sleep at night.
The item the wizard placed between them looked like a plate-sized round mirror. It hovered at face level between them, held up by the same mysterious force that kept the light globe near the ceiling. Valentine saw in it only his own reflection, but fuzzy and out of focus, conforming to his general outline.
What is this?
A moose face appeared in the mirror. The Life Weaver's visage melted and shifted as though his skin were made of clouds boiling in the wind.
You could say it's the surgeon's scalpel, David. I will use it to operate on you. There is a cup in front of you. Drink up.
Valentine looked down at the woven rug. A wooden cup, round like a hollowed-out coconut, sat before him. Had it been sitting there all the time? Valentine sniffed at it suspiciously.
Just a little something to facilitate the ceremony. It is tasteless.
Valentine drank. Just before consciousness faded, he looked into the mirror thing. First he saw his face, then the wizard's, then a wolf's. The images flickered together. Wizard, wolf, self, wizard, wolf, self, wizard, wolf, self. But they were not his, not Amu's. The wolf's. Valentine found himself fixing on the eyes of the three faces as they morphed from one manifestation to the next, all sharing the same ice-blue stare. The young wolf awoke to an overwhelming farrago of sounds and smells. The pine needles, musty rugs, dried lichens on the walls, and living wolves all vied to overthrow his brain. He could hear their heartbeats as with a stethoscope. Their breathing sounded like a gale. Too much, his brain shrieked at him. Valentine leaped up and hurled himself away from the sleeping pack as if flung by a catapult, bruising himself with the force of the impact against the wall.
David, stay calm. Your senses are just sharpened up a little, that's all. I will help you through your first days. Then you will learn on your own. You must learn to switch your senses between two levels, hard and soft. You have to learn how to hear with soft ears and smell with soft nose first. You will use the hard ears and hard nose later to sense over distance.
Where are you?
Valentine could hear the echo of his voice in the outer cavern where he had waited before being called.
I have linked us. I cannot understand you very well. I am not as gifted as some in this type of communication with human thought shapes. I just get impressions about your emotions. You need to take a deep breath. Fill your lungs with air and relax. Draw everything back into your center. Soften your eyes. Let them go out of focus. Soften your ears. Let them relax and listen to the sound of the empty air in front of you. Soften your nose and smell the heat of the light cube.
Valentine tried to relax, but the smell and sound of the slumbering wolves kept beating down the barriers. He felt dazed.
You are doing very well. I think you are a natural. Try to walk out of the cave the way you came in.
The musty old tapestry at the door reeked abominably, and Valentine hurried past it. His legs were suddenly working too fast, and he crashed into the cavern wall, like a mechanized toy bouncing off an obstacle in its path. He steadied himself, but the flickering candles sounded like whip cracks in his ears.
Center! Center! No, you still don't have it. Let me help you.
Valentine felt himself steady, the cacophony of sensations fading into the background. He made it to the other curtain, but as he pushed through it, the acidic vomit smell overthrew him.
Serves you right.
Valentine leaped forward in alarm, but could not keep control of his spastic body and missed the exit. He ricocheted off the unforgiving stone and came away bleeding at the forehead. The coppery-smelling fluid infiltrated his nostrils, took over his sense of smell.
Breathe. Breathe. Bring it back to your center. Try crawling outside. You're fine.
The young wolf did not feel fine.
Hell, I think Father Wolf turned him all the way up.
He heard the man's whisper behind cupped palm. On hands and knees, Valentine crawled through the cave, toward the light outside. He could smell the blood trail behind.
The wizard thought that Marquez was something special too. Sent him right off the cliff.
Valentine, remembering what had happened yesterday, brought himself back down with a determined effort. The world seemed almost normal. He climbed to his feet.
Good, good. Outdoors can be a little much. Just keep breathing into your center and drawing everything back to that place inside you. You will learn in time. A good bloodhound controls his nose without even realizing it. The way you focus your eyes, you will be able to do the same soon.
Valentine made it into the daylight. Clear blue filled the sky overhead, a rarity on Kurian Earth. The snow seemed to gleam, and even across the valley, Valentine's visual acuity was such that he literally could not see the forest for the individual trees. It smelled as if he were standing in the center of the world's largest goat farm, despite the fact that the three goats stood 100 yards away, downwind. He centered on his own body.
David, try to find some goat droppings.
The voice in his head still made him uncomfortable, although his nose told him he was in a sea of goat shit. Valentine localized it with an effort and walked toward the still warm source, pausing less and less frequently as he drew nearer. He found he could play with his ears as easily as his eyes. He located a creaking branch and listened to one of the goats pull up fodder from beneath the snow.
There you are.
Valentine stood over the rounded mass, the end of his pungent treasure hunt.
Now, David, you are doing excellently. Follow the trail the goats left, not by using the tracks in the snow, but with your nose. Shut your eyes as much as possible. Hear and smell your way down the mountainside.
It occurred to him that none of the other wolves had explored the field in this way. Valentine would have known, since most of them had left within the last few hours, and there were only a few irregular, staggering footprints in the field. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes, and began to smell for the trail left by the odoriferous goats. And fell flat on his face. A tree root, hidden in the snow, snagged his foot. Usually, Valentine was agile enough to catch himself if tripped, but his usual reflexes had gone AWOL. He had the disquieting sensation of being in a different body. The only memory he could compare it to was his rare all-day fishing expeditions in Minnesota, taking a small boat into a lake and then feeling a little unsteady on his feet when he returned to dry land. He got up, closed his eyes again with an effort, and began walking with an unsteady tread like a drunk doing a Frankenstein's monster imitation. Valentine found he could hear the location of trees by the sound of wind in the pine needles. He sensed a branch ahead and leaned back to avoid it. And fell flat on his back. The goats showed a penchant for investigating clumps of thorny bramble.
Damn it!
After a painful rake across his lips, Valentine opened his eyes.
No peeking.
Valentine sucked the blood from his punctured lip, took a deep breath, and tried again. He leaned forward and found the going easier with his hands placed ahead and his nose closer to the trail. Even when he bashed his head straight into a tree trunk, coming away with sticky pine bark tangled in his hair, he managed to keep his eyes closed. He found himself able to concentrate on the trail, letting the other senses fade into the background, like a reader absorbed in a book, using just her eyes and her brain. The odor became stronger, and Valentine let out a yip like a foxhound. He began to lope, ignoring the bruises and scrapes as he bounced down the slope. He heard a panicked bleat from something ripe and warm. And he leaped. The goat collapsed under him, kicking. The animal's struggles brought him out of his trance. He found himself with a mouthful of goat hair, feeling as if he had just woken from a vivid dream. He released the unfortunate herbivore.
Sorry, Billy. I got carried away.
Terrible!
The wizard shouted into his brain.
Had you been following someone with a gun, they would have shot you like a frothing dog. You mustn't go feral. Do it again, but this time see if you can find one of your fellow wolves as they disperse. Just follow him. Don't let him see you. Open your eyes now and then if you must, but try to work with your former semi-dormant senses as much as possible. Practice, because when it's for real, there are no second chances.
David Ballantyne, Wolf of the Southern Command, got his new, awkward, battered body to its feet, closed his eyes, and stalked on.
Vampire Earth is continued on the next CD.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Chuckwagon tales told by the survivors of the Battle of Hazlitt described a push into the valuable mining towns of the area from the tip of Illinois. The Quislings and Grogs made a fortress of the little crossroads town, and only a concentration of every available bear in eastern Missouri, backed up by wolves and a guard regiment, forced them out again. It might have been worse, but Ballantyne learned that a company of wolves had ambushed reinforcements at the Mississippi, sacrificing themselves to keep the road to Hazlitt closed. Out of 100 wolves, a bare 16 now licked their wounds on the banks of the Whitewater River. It was this destruction of Foxtrot Company that led Captain LaHave, the senior wolf officer in the area, to send for Ballantyne one afternoon. Zulu Company was preparing to return below the state line again, as an incursion in the northeast might mean an even larger one in the southwest. Ballantyne wondered, as he answered the summons that afternoon, what the news would be. LaHave always hit his officers, whenever possible, with bitter medicine early in the morning and saved the sugar for evenings. So an afternoon conference might be a trail mix assortment of sweet and sour. Ballantyne found LaHave by a commissary wagon sharing a cup of coffee with an unknown, clean-shaven wolf.
David Ballantyne, meet Randall Harper. Sergeant Harper here is part of the command staff. A courier, to be exact.
The young men shook hands. Harper seemed a little young to be a sergeant, particularly on the command staff, but then Ballantyne was even younger to be a lieutenant. The courier's cheerful smile brightened his whole face to such a degree that Ballantyne liked him from first sight.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
Ballantyne, you were going on a trip. I need some young legs to accompany Harper here on a 400-mile jaunt, all the way up to Lake Michigan, as a matter of fact.
I've got 2 bags of mail and 1 of dispatches, sir.
Why me, sir?
Normally, an officer from Foxtrot Company and another wolf would go, but as of these last few days, Foxtrot doesn't exist anymore and probably won't for another year or so. There's only acting lieutenants in the junior position in the other 2 wolf companies, and I don't know enough about them to pick one. And you're from the Great White North, so I thought you'd like a trip back up. I was going to send you up with Paul Samuels anyway on one of his recruiting sweeps, but this'll be a better experience for you.
Mounted or afoot, sir?
With a little luck, you'll be mounted all the way. 3 horses plus a spare is what you have, right, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. The 4th would carry the mail and some oats, or if we lose one, it'll be a remount.
So a 3rd man is going, sir. Who will that be?
LaHave patted Ballantyne on the shoulder.
Take who you want, Ballantyne. Except for Patel, I need him. And he's too old to cover 40 miles a day for long stretches anymore.
Ballantyne mentally ran down the list of wolves in Zulu Company.
I'll take Gonzalez, sir. He has the best nose in the company, and he's first rate with his hunting bow.
Take him with my compliments, Lieutenant. Let me know your needs. I realize the company wagons haven't caught up with us yet, but I can probably scrounge you up just about anything. Questions?
The only questions that came to Valentine's mind implied evading responsibility, so he remained silent.
You two get together with Gonzalez and talk it through. I know you've made the trip a couple of times, Harper, so tell as much about the route to the other two as you can, just in case. You leave at dawn.
Gladly, sir.
Harper accepted the possibility of his death, suggested by the just-in-case, with the same sunny smile. That evening, Gonzalez joined them in an informal campfire conference.
Seems like a lot of effort to deliver a few letters. How often do you do this?
2 or 3 times a year. Southern Command tries to stay in touch with the other resistance pockets, at least the big ones. This is information we don't want to broadcast on the shortwave. That's why if it looks like we're going to be taken, you need to pour the fluid in the flasks onto the dispatches and burn them.
If the Reapers are closing in, I'm going to be too busy to start any fire, Sarge.
Valentine mopped up his stew with a slab of bread.
How long are we going to be gone?
It depends on the horses, and then the sailors. If we can come up with feed now and then, about 2 weeks per leg, but there's no guarantee the ship will be in Whitefish Bay on time. The lake's fleet has trouble of its own. Luckily, the Kurians don't pay much attention to the ships unless they get too close to a city they care about. We'll just have to wait if they aren't there.
Never had any problems running the mail?
Harper's smile returned.
A few close shaves. We should keep toward the Mississippi until the Wisconsin border or so. About all you have to worry about there is border trash, but they're mostly scared of everything. Wisconsin has the real Kurian lands we have to cross. Their pet humans farm that area pretty good. And of course, the Reapers farm the humans. The shortest route would be up through central Illinois, but that's thickly settled. And unless you have a death wish, you want to keep away from Chicago.
Valentine and Gonzalez bade farewell to their company in the pre-dawn gloom. Lahav offered a final word of advice to his junior lieutenant.
Keep your eyes open, Mr. Valentine.
Lahav solemnly shook his protege's hand.
We never know enough about what's happening in the Lost Lands. Try and pick up any information you can, even if it's just impressions.
Thank you for the opportunity, sir.
Lahav winced. How many young men have you sent to their doom with those words on their lips? Valentine wondered.
You can thank me by coming back, David.
The three wolves mounted their horses, the excited animals stamping and tossing their heads in their eagerness to be off, and rode into the misty dawn.
Possessed of an unnatural and legendary hunger, the Reapers have come to Earth to establish a new order built on the harvesting of enslaved human souls. They rule the planet. They thrive on the scent of fear. And if it is night, as sure as darkness, they will come.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth. Narrated by Ken Jackson. Performed by Tim Getman, Karen Novak, Jeff Baker, Jonathan Watkins, Michael John Casey, Thomas Penny, Peter Stray, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, James Lewis, Tony Nam, Michael Glenn, Casey Platt, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Graybill. The Vampire Earth Saga, Book 1, Way of the Wolf, Part 2.
During the first leg of their journey, the wolf courier and his two escorts kept to the rough terrain of the Mississippi Valley. They conserved the strength of horse and rider, walking their mounts and stopping often. On the second day, they crossed the Mississippi in a hollowed-out old houseboat, well camouflaged with dirt and plant growth on its battered sides. The trio of old wolves who took them across laughed as they listened to the second-hand story of the Battle of Hazlitt over the labored putting of the aged diesel engine.
That'll learn them.
As the man spoke, he brought the houseboat out of its hidden cove and into the current at the all-clear signal from his observer.
Hank and I, we've been putting up signs all over the West Bank for miles, reading, "Trespassers will be prosecuted and no solicitors invited." Them grogs don't read too good.
Once in no man's land, the wolves traveled cautiously. They camped for the night when they found the right spot, not when the sun set. Daybreak never found them in the same location in which they bedded down. Each night, Valentine ordered a camp change of at least a half mile, and lost sleep was made up with a siesta each afternoon during the worst of the late summer heat. They set no watch, but relied on their senses to rouse them from their light slumber in the event of danger. They always cooked their meals before dark, knowing better than to call attention to themselves with the light of a campfire. By the third night out, they were swapping life stories. Valentine had heard Gonzalez's before, but listened again to his scout's words as he lay in his hammock under a cloud-masked moon.
I was born in Texas in 2041, out there in the western part. My parents were part of a guerrilla band called the Screaming Eagles. My father told me it was an old army unit that mi madre said was a music group. They used to do a war cry. I would do it, but it was too loud for these parts. Too loud for the Ozarks, too. I don't remember much fighting when I was young. I think the Eagles stole cattle off the turncoats. That was what we called the Quislings out there. Sometimes in the summer, we went as far north as Kansas and Colorado. And in the winter, we would be in Mexico. And I was about 12 when the turncoats got us. It was in Mexico. We were in this kind of bowl-shaped valley. A few old buildings and tents, you know, with the cattle all spread out. They got some cannon up in the hill somehow, and pretty soon there were explosions everywhere with men on horseback pouring down from the mountains. My father fought them, but I'm sure he was killed with the rest. And there were just two passes out of the valley, but they had hundreds of men with guns hidden in the rocks. I don't think anyone made it out that way. And Mazda got me and my baby brother out over the hills. One of the turncoats caught up to us. He attacked her, but I picked up his gun. I shot him in the foot. He grabbed the gun out of my hands, and he was going to shoot me. But my madre brought a boulder as big as a football down on his head and killed him. God knows how she found the strength to lift it. She was a small woman.
Gonzalez fingered a small silver crucifix around his neck.
We walked for days, and would have died, but a rainstorm saved us. We hid for a while in a turncoat village. An old man who was kind to us arranged for my mother to move to eastern Texas, where his son lived. My mother lived with his son and had a child with him, but she never loved him as she did my father, even though he was very good to us. She gave him two daughters, but when I turned 16, she said, "Victor, you must leave this land, for there are people here who have forgotten themselves and God." We heard rumors about a place in the mountains where the hooded ones could not go, and I found this place on my own, but I fear it went bad for my stepfather, who let me run away. But I know my madre still lives, because I still live. Her prayers protect me and keep me alive. With what I have seen, I cannot pray as she does. So when she dies, I would die too.
Valentine told his story next, leaving out the fact that his father had been a wolf. He described the cool beauty of the Boundary Waters, woods and lakes, and the challenge of living through a Minnesota winter.
Then it was Harper's turn.
I hadn't seen much geography until I became a wolf. I was born to a big family near Fort Scott. My pa was an officer in the Guards, and he tried to keep me in school, but I wouldn't have it. At 9, I tried to be an aspirant, but they wouldn't let me. I hung out in wolf camps whenever I could. My pa was away a lot, and my ma, well, she had her hands full with the other children. They finally let me become an aspirant at 13. I was invoked when I was 15, and I was in the middle of it at Cedar Hill and then Big River. They made me a sergeant after all that. I was a champion distance runner, so I got put in the couriers. I made a trip to the Gulf in 63 and did the run to Lake Michigan twice last year. I crossed Tennessee this spring going to the Appalachians, and that's the worst run I've ever been on. Took me forever to find resistance people in the Smokies. These trips should be run by just couriers, but we've lost so many out west over one thing and another, the command is short on messengers.
I was wondering why you showed up with two empty saddles.
Well, I'm grateful for your company, Mr. Valentine. You seem to be a right smart officer, afraid of all the right things, if you'll excuse me for saying so, sir. And Gonzalez, you, sir, have the most righteous set of ears in the free territory. I'm glad you're along to count the mouse farts, you know?
Gonzalez proved just how good his hearing was somewhere east of Galena, Illinois. They had been traveling for a week when someone began trailing them.
There are three or four riders coming up from behind. Haven't caught sight of them yet, but you can hear them. I don't know if they're right on our trail or just keeping with the old road.
The three wolves rode parallel to an old road, now overgrown, but still too far from tall timber for their purposes. Valentine debated the choices. An ambush would be easy enough to set up, but he balked at shooting down strangers in cold blood. Anyone close enough for the wolves to hear would probably have cut their trail by now and would know someone was ahead. The idea of being trailed worried him.
Do you know who lives around here?
This far off the river? A few farmers scratch a living out here. On other trips, we've crossed the trails of pretty big groups on horseback. I don't like thinking worst case, but this is just the kind of area a pair of reapers might hunt.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be on horseback, and they wouldn't make enough noise for Gonzo to hear them.
As usual, someone else's opinion helped him form his own, for better or worse.
Let's go up the bluffs. If they're casual travelers, they won't follow. If they come up after us, we can get a good look at what we're taking on before we start shooting.
With that, the wolves made a sharp turn east, moving into the wooded hills away from the overgrown road. Valentine removed his lever-action rifle from its sheath. Soon, they were struggling up a steep slope, leaning far forward in their saddles to help the horses balance. As they ascended the hill, Valentine searched right and left. No rock pile or fallen trunk presented itself. Valentine cursed his luck at riding for the one uneroded hill covered with uniformly healthy timber in all of western Illinois. Gaining the summit, the wolves at last found a deadfall they could hide behind. The breeze blew fresh from the west, hard enough to whip at the horses' manes and make the men clutch at their hats. They rode past the fallen log and looped back. Tracks heading straight for an ambush spot would be investigated more cautiously.
Harper, you stay here and hold the four horses out of sight behind the crest of the hill.
Dismounted, with weapons in hand, Valentine and Gonzalez walked back to the fallen log. Gonzalez held an arrow to his bowstring. With luck, the trackers had a single scout out front who could be silently dispatched with a feathered shaft.
Keep your bow ready, Gonzo. I'm gonna get in that oak above our trail. There's just two scouts, I'll drop on one. When you see me leap, try for the other with the bow. If it's three or four, I'll let him ride past and I'll back shoot him.
Let me go up the tree, sir.
I'm not much with a bow, my friend. I doubt I could hit a horse at this distance, let alone a rider. Just stay cool and wait for my signal.
Valentine scrambled to his perch among the thick limbs of the grandfather oak. He hugged the tree limbs like a lizard, pulling a leafy branch toward his face for concealment. Whoever the trackers were, they had four scouts ahead on horseback. Valentine listened with hard ears past them, but his nose helped even more. A large group of horses and men were somewhere out of sight, upwind to the west. He smelled some tobacco and cannabis as well. As the scouts walked their horses up the slope and into view, Valentine decided this was no quisling patrol. The shabbiness of man and beast, from worn-out boots to collapsed felt hat brims, indicated either the worst kind of quisling irregulars or simple bandits. They carried rifles, but some of the guns looked like black powder muzzle loaders. Whatever their deficiencies in equipment, the four scouts knew their jobs. One concentrated on the trail, two a little behind him searched the terrain ahead, and the fourth stayed far back in case of trouble. One of the middle scouts didn't like the look of the hilltop, and they pulled up to a halt. Binoculars and small telescopes emerged from their patched overcoats. One of the four wolf horses scented those below. The scouts spun their horses and plunged down the hill.
Damn! Damn! Damn!
A good second line of defense, Valentine maintained, is running like hell. Waving to Gonzalez, he ran up toward the four horses.
It's border trash, I think. A lot.
Valentine led them at something less than a flat-out gallop along the ridgeline. Their horses had covered a lot of miles in the past week, but perhaps were of sterner stuff and in better health than the beasts of the ragamuffins below.
Woo!
Valentine reveled in the mad inconsequence of it all. Their pursuers might catch them, he and the two wolves might die, and the world would change or care not a whit. But it felt glorious to pound through the woods on a running horse, his legs tight in the stirrups and hands far up the horse's neck. Clods of dirt kicked up by the horse's rhythmic gait flew up behind like birds startled at their passing. Valentine chided himself. Harper had been having trouble with the spare horse. The sane part of his mind chided Valentine. He spotted a clearing on a prominence ahead and turned his horse toward it, slowing the pace to a trot and then a walk. Reaching the bare spot, they saw a ruined house, roofless and empty.
We covered some miles. Where the hell is the road?
Somewhere down to the west of us.
Valentine waved vaguely at the descending sun. trees obscured the road's probable location.
Let's take a breather and see how our friends are doing.
The overlook gave them a good view of the hills to the south. The wolves listened to the steady drum of hooves in the distance.
Oh, shit. I always figured a reaper would get me, not some grubby thugs.
Valentine looked at the house. There were good walls there, and only two doors to cover. The horses would fit inside.
Okay, so their horses are fresher than ours. We still got three guns and a good spot to shoot from.
He could see now distant riders galloping along the trail. He stopped counting after estimating 50.
Let's get inside our new home and get ready to greet our guests.
Behind the house, a pump stood on a concrete patio.
Oh, pretty please with sugar on it.
Harper worked the pump handle. It moved a little too easily. Nothing came from the rusty metal spout but noise. The main room of the house was filled with collapsed roof, but they were able to bring the horses through the back door into a room slightly lower than the larger one. The paneless windows were set so a man at the front could cover the main door, more or less, but the western exposure of rooms off the main one would have to go unguarded. Valentine posted himself at the front window, Harper at the side, and Gonzalez at the rear door. They manhandled an empty refrigerator into the doorway to the main room.
We ought to be able to hold out for about 2 minutes now.
There's always the chance we'll make the price too steep for him.
Valentine filled a pocket with cartridges.
I was sick of riding anyway.
That's the idea. If we can get him to wait till dark, we just might be able to slip out. Head for the steep hills and thick woods. Maybe all they want is the horses. I know we can outrun them on foot, even carrying the mail. Whoever they are, they're not wolves.
Their pursuers approached their refuge with caution. A thin man with a ragged straw hat bearing a single black feather in the brim trotted up toward the house, carbine at his hip. He turned his face suspiciously, first looking at the ruined dwelling with one eye, then the other. Valentine sighted on his dirty undershirt.
That's far enough! What's on your mind?
The thin man's long face split into a grin.
You boys want a parley?
We're willing to let lead fly if you want it that way. Might be better for both of us if we talk first.
Straw Hat turned his horse and disappeared downslope. Valentine counted the minutes. Every moment toward dusk helped their cause. He heard horses moving through the woods below the hill. The pursuers were fanning out to surround the house. It sounded like a lot of riders. Three heavy figures on tall quarter horses approached the house. Even beneath beard and dirt, Valentine thought he saw a family resemblance. Their scruffy beards were black as coal, save for the center rider, who had two narrow streaks of gray running down his beard. Their hats also bore black feathers tucked in the left side of the hat band, like that of the point man.
Hello, the house! You wanted a parley, here it is!
May I know to whom I'm speaking?
The man glanced at his younger associates.
Sure, stranger. My name's Mr. Mind Your Own Damn Business. This is my son, or I'll tear off your head, and my nephew, and I'll shit down your throat. That satisfy the rules of etiquette?
A few guffaws broke out from below.
Charming. Why don't you plan him, Lieutenant?
Valentine kept his concentration on the rider.
Thank you, Mr. Mind. Looks like you got four of us in a box. Is there a way for us to get out without a bunch of you winding up dead?
Oh, now maybe there's four of you, and maybe there's three. One of your horses is riding light, so maybe you got a woman or a kid in there to think about.
All we're thinking about is how many of you we can take with us. The consensus is 20. If you're smart enough to know what a claymore mine is, you'll agree that it's at least that.
Son, we can smoke you out of there easy. You'd be better off to take my terms. Leave us your rifles and give us the horses and tack. You can keep all your food, all your water, and your handguns if you got them. And your lives. Even your self-respect, knowing that you met the Black Feather Troop and lived to tell about it.
You want the guns? You just try and get them.
Valentine tried to keep the calm assurance of Captain LaHave in his voice.
You'll get plenty of the business end. How about this? We give you the horses and the tack and walk out of here after you pull out.
No bargaining! I'm giving you 5 minutes to talk it over. You're up a dry hill in a building you can't even cover all the sides of. Bring out your rifles and we'll let you walk out and keep heading north.
He spoke with the assurance of a man holding four aces. Valentine knew he was beat on card strength. but he believed they wouldn't live to see the sunrise if they walked out of the house without their rifles. The men turned to him, having reached the same conclusions and wanting to go down shooting.
Okay, Gonzo, Harper, get out your blades. There's something we have to do.
Cut the horses' throats?
Valentine decided there was still a chance at bluff.
Nope, we have to whittle.
5 minutes later, but with over an hour of daylight left, Valentine stepped out of the door with the three rifles in his arms. He inflated his lungs and threw out his chest. The three black feathers startled at the cry, which didn't seem to echo off the hills so much as pass through them.
Come and get your guns!
Valentine advanced a cautious pair of steps away from the door. His holster was empty. Harper covered him from behind with the revolver.
You made the smart move, son.
The three rode forward to claim the repeaters. Valentine carefully placed them on the ground and stepped back. The older man dismounted. He knelt to pick up one of the guns.
So, there's only three of you. I thought so. These are mighty fine.
The man pulled his hands away from the rifle as if it were a rattlesnake shaking its tail. Carved into the stock of each rifle was a small insignia, a reversed swastika identical to the one Valentine had seen on the canoe and discussed with the researcher at the Miskatonic. He looked up at Valentine, lips trembling.
Where'd you get these?
Our masters gave them to us. The mark is on the saddles as well. I even have a tattoo. We're scouting for them, you see. Eight of them moving west as we speak. So take them, but we'll have them back by the morning. In good condition, too. They'll only be dropped once.
Now, son, we had no knowing you had anything to do with the Twisted Cross. Hell, we're no enemies of yours. You might say we're on your side. Just this spring, we caught a cat out of the Ozarks. Reeling spitfire. The boys ganged her, and we cut her throat, of course. You can ask Lord Malachi's Cur in Rockford. We pay for what we take there with good silver, turned in runners even.
Valentine smiled.
Seems we've just had a misunderstanding here. No one was hurt. No one need know, Mr.
It's Black Craig Lorraine, sir. At your service. If there's anything we can do to help you along, anything at all.
The black feather was almost groveling.
Come to think of it.
Valentine returned to the house, holding the rifles.
He folded.
Harper handed the pistol back.
Eh?
They're letting us go. In fact, they're giving us some supplies. Problem is, they're cannibals, so I had to promise them Gonzalez since he's the plumpest of us.
Bad joke, Val. That was a joke, right?
That night, the wolves rode north with guns, horses, and a new shoe on the spare horse. They were also weighed down by bags of corn, grain, and food from the supplies of the Black Feathers.
Jesus, Lieutenant. When you did that Reaper scream, I about crapped my pants. Could have warned us.
One of the Black Feathers, part of the dispersing ring to the north, waved in a friendly fashion. Gonzalez eyed him warily.
That was a joke, right, Lieutenant?
Milwaukee, August of the 43rd year of the Kurian Order. The burned-out corpse of a city that once held nearly 2 million people rots across some 80 square miles on the shores of Lake Michigan. From the steep hills overlooking the Great Lake in the east to the Menominee and Root Rivers in the west, the city is nothing but hollow shells of buildings, the upper stories now housing bats, hawks, pigeons, and seagulls. The lower levels shelter everything from rats and coyotes to vagrant humans. Green has covered pavement throughout much of the city. Crickets chirp and grasshoppers leap along Locust Avenue, and Greenfield Avenue is precisely that, a green field where cattle are moved along to graze. The new center of the city is the railway station, where the more favored soldiers and technicians house themselves in a ring around the Grand Avenue Mall. A hobo jungle of casual labor lives around and under the spaghetti strand warren of overpasses that make up the old Interstate 94-43 juncture. Two Kurian lords run the city, one from the grog-guarded 1950 bomb shelter under the federal building, and the other from Torrey Hill on the grounds of Marquette University. The Miller Brewing Company is still in business, producing but a trickle of the Pilsner torrent it once did, under new management, of course. Lake Michigan awed Valentine with its quiet majesty. It had nothing of the crashing drama of the ocean shoreline he knew from books. The expanse of water covering 180 degrees of the horizon in almost a north-south line impressed him nonetheless. Valentine and Randall Harper camped together north of Whitefish Bay. They had left Gonzalez in a secluded barn far outside the city limits with the horses after a cautious but uneventful crossing of southern Wisconsin. The only difficulty had been from a pack of guard dogs at a lonely farming settlement who chased them out of a field where they were stealing corn for the horses. The dogs contented themselves with barking rather than biting, and the wolves had hurried back to their mounts without injury to anything but their dignity. Now, each night, they stood behind a 4-foot-tall, decorative stone wall in an overgrown park overlooking the lake, waiting for a boat from the White Banner fleet to show 3 lights, one flickering, which they would answer with 2.
What exactly is this flotilla?
Harper, comfortably seated with his back to the stone wall, took a puff of one of the noxious cigarettes he smoked.
They're sympathetic to the cause, even if they don't fight the Kurians tooth and nail. They're smugglers, gun runners, traitors. When they fight the Quislings, it's more because somebody got double-crossed, or they asked for too big a payoff. The Hoods hate going out into blue water, I'm told, so they leave it to the Quislings and some amphibian grogs. Naturally, the Quislings take bribes whenever they can get away with it, but the flotilla always fights the grogs whenever they get the chance. It's a real blood feud. I guess these grogs are more partial to human flesh than most.
Oh, I think I've heard of these. Big mouths, snappers or whatever. They have jaws that open right to left instead of up and down, right? Kind of fish frog things.
Yep, slimy skin like an eel. They're a problem in summer. They go dormant in winter. The real danger's in the spring when they lay their eggs. You gotta keep away from the shores of the places they inhabit. They forage miles inland for food. They like the water a little shallower, though, so they're not such a problem here. Up by Green Bay, it's another story, though. Lake Erie is stiff with them, they tell me.
Valentine thought of all the times that he had taken a boat out into the lakes of the Boundary Waters, collecting fish for dinner. Strange to think of fish emerging and hunting ashore.
So, why does the fleet carry our mail for us?
The hunters in upstate New York give them guns and ammo, that's why. Rope, lumber, paint, turpentine, engines, gasoline, all sorts of stuff. We're lucky. We're just delivery boys. We don't have to worry about payoffs. But I got a little grease for the wheels in my bag. It's sort of expected.
Valentine shrugged.
Whatever it takes. You'd think they'd be on our side.
They are. They are. In fact, I guarantee that you'll like them. Those sailors got a million stories. Of course, most of it's lies and brag, but it's still fun to listen to.
I'll bet.
The next night, the boat arrived. Valentine almost missed it, having wolf-trotted back to Gonzalez's barn to check on things at the main camp. Both the horses and his scout looked better for a few days' rest. Gonzalez had explored the area, finding some apple trees and rhubarb growing nearby. The scout had collected a basket of green apples and an armful of rhubarb and was sharing his findings with the horses.
I saw some tomatoes near there, too. I'll get them tomorrow, sir.
Yeah, just make sure you're not raiding somebody's field. You might end up dealing with something worse than dogs. I don't want any locals to suspect we're here.
No tracks, no sign. And best of all, no reapers.
I hope not. Sleep light. I'll take some apples back. You have no objections, Mr. Bountiful.
Valentine filled his pockets.
Of course, Lieutenant. Give a few to the sergeant with my compliments.
It was a tired lieutenant who returned to the overlook that evening, having covered 15 miles on foot in the course of the day. 2 hours after sunset, the 3 lights appeared on the dark lake.
There she blows.
Harper's quote was a curious allusion. Valentine was mentally reciting 2 on the land and 3 in the sea, and I on the outskirts of Milwaukee will be. Harper poured his flammable liquid onto 2 piles of wood, 12 feet apart on the lakeside of the overlook wall, and set them ablaze. 1 light on the boat began winking on and off as somebody opened and closed a hooded lantern.
Are you satisfied it's them?
Yes.
Valentine tried to make out the lines of the little ship.
Then let's go down to the beach, sir, and deliver the mail.
The ship bobbed in the small swell of the lake. The waters of Lake Michigan did not roar as they struck the shoreline, but instead gently slapped it. The lake almost seemed playful on this idyllic summer evening, and something about the cool water and the warm evening breeze made Valentine forget the dangers of the night. The men waded out, weighed down with their waterproof message bags. A tiny dinghy met them, its sides a bare 16 inches out of the water.
in sideways.
A boy's voice spoke from the stern.
You'll capsize me if you try to vault in.
The wolves threw their packs into the dink and rolled into the little boat. It settled in the water appreciably with their added weight. Valentine looked into the stern, at the figure with the paddle. What he had thought was a young boy was in fact a young woman, dressed in shapeless white canvas. She had a round face and merry eyes, looking at her passengers over freckled cheekbones.
Nice night, eh, boys? Captain Doss sends her compliments to the representatives of the Ozark Free Territory and invites you aboard the Yol White Lightning.
Valentine realized he had heard a foreign accent for the first time in his life. The woman flashed an impressive set of teeth.
The what? White Lightning?
Yol. You know, nothing a ship, soldier?
Not much.
It's a little thing, but seaworthy as a porpoise. A ship not very different from ours made it around the world with only a single man on board. Over 100 years ago, that was.
Good to see you again.
Harper contemplated his soaked deerskin breeches.
Terry, is it?
I thought you looked familiar. Aaron, no. Randall Harper. Met you twice before, I recall. But I didn't see you this spring.
I had the overland route. I don't want it again.
Well, the captain will be glad to see you. So who's this with you?
Lieutenant David Valentine. He hails from Minnesota.
She reached over to shake Valentine's hand.
Pleased to meet you, Lieutenant. Terry Silvertongue, first mate of the White Lightning. Will it be possible for you gentlemen to be joining us as guests this lovely evening?
Can't think of anything I'd like more, Miss Silvertongue.
Valentine tried to imitate her courteous phraseology. He wondered if Silvertongue was a nickname.
We go by Mr. in the flotilla, man or woman. Just as you do in the wolves. Will you take an oar, sir?
I beg your pardon, Mr. Silvertongue. Sergeant Harper here didn't tell me the ship had a female crew, let alone how you expected to be addressed. Likes to keep a good thing to himself, I guess.
Valentine shot a glance at Harper as he paddled for the white blob outside the gentle surf.
Oh, there's plenty of men in the flotilla. The Commodore of our fleet just has a soft spot in her heart for any woman with a sad tale. It's the only soft spot she has. The woman has steel in her backbone and flint in her heart and all other matters except her poor foundlings, as she calls them. But yes, it's three women on the Lightning. But it beats life on land. The Capos just wants us for breeding stock, and the gunbelt lackeys seem to think they have the right to get the job started on any girl who tickles their fancy.
Capos?
That's what we call the reapers out east, handsome boy.
The dinghy reached the ship, and Valentine got a good look at the White Lightning. Her lines had kind of an off-balanced beauty, with an oversized central mast set well forward and a smaller secondary mast projecting from far astern. Captain Doss wore a smart white semi-uniform to greet her guests. The captain had beautiful dusky skin and the angular features of a storybook pirate queen. Her short black hair matched even Valentine's own mane in its glossy sheen. A third woman, who helped Valentine and Harper into the White Lightning, stood over 6 feet tall and had the long, graceful limbs of a ballerina.
Give me the bags up.
Once on board, the White Lightning seemed smaller than it had looked from the dinghy. It was wide-waisted. The top of what was obviously the cabin area filled the middle third of the ship. It had a wheel to steer it. Someone had spent a lot of hours carving and polishing the spokes, placed in front of the rear mast. All the woodwork, save the planks of the deck and the decorative wheel, was painted a uniform light gray. The captain introduced her crew.
You've met my first mate, Mr. Silvertongue. My second mate, who works so hard I don't need any more crew, is Eva Stepanek. She crossed the Atlantic 4 round trips before ending up in the lakes.
It will be more times, once I have goods enough for my own ship.
You mean gold enough?
No, sir. Goods. In Riga is agent of tradings, who pays most for paintings brought back from America. I am here collecting arts.
The captain smiled.
It's hard not to indulge someone so determined. And she's a hard bargainer. I don't know a Picasso from an espresso, but I think our Mr. Stepanek has enough to start a gallery.
But I'm forgetting my manners.
Harper reached into his haversack.
Captain, compliments on my last trip through Tennessee.
He handed over a pair of elaborately wrapped and sealed bottles of liquor. In the muted light, Valentine couldn't read the black labels, but they looked authentic.
Huh. Sergeant Harper, you just bought us a new coat of paint and maybe some standing rigging. My thanks to you, sir.
Harper pointed to the 3 bags of correspondence.
You'll also find a box of cigars for each of you in those bags. If you don't smoke them yourselves, a little good tobacco helps grease the Quisling wheels, I believe.
Oh, your southern gentlemen are too kind. I wish those Green Mountain boys would show the same courtesy.
Silvertongue managed a curtsy involving her over-baggy trousers.
All right, enough play acting. I'd like to be anchored off Adolf's bunker by midnight. You wolves want to pay a call on Milwaukee? Get a little taste of life in the KZ?
We're always interested in the Kurian Zone, but would that be wise, Captain?
Well, Lieutenant, the Pathfinder look would have to go. But we've got some extra whites in the slop chest. The bunker's a rough spot, but I've never heard of the Reapers going in there. The owner never makes trouble. In fact, I've heard he turns troublemakers over to them. I'd like a little extra muscle showing for the deal we need to do. I'll make it worth your while.
Valentine thought for a moment.
Is this deal anything the New Order would object to?
If they knew about it, Lieutenant, you might say we're fucking with the Quislings.
Doss was looking at the wind telltale. The tiny streamer fluttered east.
Count us in, then.
An hour later, the yawl tacked into Milwaukee's harbor. A single, decrepit police boat, piloted by a Quisling whose sole badge of rank was a grimy blue shirt, motored alongside and illuminated the white lightning with a small spotlight. Captain Doss held up a hand and flashed a series of hand signals that would have done a third base coach proud. The Quisling nodded, satisfied.
Just arranging what you might call the port charges.
Valentine nodded. The wolves now wore white canvas shirts and trousers as well. While more tattered than the mate's uniforms, they still found it a pleasant change from sweat-stained buckskins. During the run south, Valentine had questioned the captain about the lake's flotilla and its havocs, and had learned a little about how the sails were balanced. Valentine sponged information off of anyone he met, his mind always ready to learn something new. They pulled up to the main civic pier, a cracked concrete affair that sloped toward Lake Michigan at a 20-degree angle. Valentine noticed that the captain pivoted as she brought the ship in so that its bow pointed out to the lake.
The Kurians aren't too big on infrastructure repairs.
As she spoke, Silvertongue tied the white lightning to the dock. A few boats, none of which matched Captain Doss's in lines or upkeep, bobbed along the pier.
Stepanek, you've got the first anchor watch. Don't give me that look. After the deal, I'll take over for you. If we're not back in 2 hours, or if anything goes down, you raise sail. There's a good wind for it tonight.
Aye, aye, sir.
Stepanek drew a sawed-off shotgun from the chart locker. She broke it open and inserted two loads of buckshot.
And if our broad-shouldered young men would each grab one of the barrels lashed to the mast in the cabin? Silver, help Mr. Valentine with the knots, would you? We can be about the rest of this night's business.
Adolf's bunker looked like a transplant from the Maginot Line. Whatever its original purpose, its builders had wanted it to last. They constructed it from heavy concrete, with narrow windows imitative of a castle's arrow slits. The bleached white of the concrete and the irregular rectangular slits gave it the countenance of a toothy skull. It lay on the lake shore, set well away from the dead and empty buildings frowning behind.
Why is it called Adolf's bunker?
They were approaching the squat, brick-shaped building. The 10-gallon cask grew heavier with each step.
The guy who runs it is a dictator for starts.
Silvertongue turned and looked at the men, each laboring with a cask on his shoulder.
There's a feeling about the place. It's a piece of sanity in an insane country. Or maybe a slightly different insanity within the insanity, take your pick. It's popular with the Quislings. When we found out we had to meet you this week, we contacted a Chicago big shot so we could kill two birds with one stone this trip.
As long as our bags get delivered.
This trade will make getting your bags through a lot easier.
The building seemed hollow and dead as a shucked oyster. Valentine surmised that the clientele liked to do their drinking in dark and quiet, when he realized that music, too loud to be the product of any instrument, was filtering up from somewhere beneath the building. He switched to hard ears and listened to the beat of ancient rock and roll and the gabble of voices echo up from a stairwell. Captain Doss turned to a set of narrow concrete steps that disappeared along the side of the building, down into the earth. A knobless metal door opened out onto a small landing. Doss squatted down and said something into the hole. It swung open. As he descended the stairs, Valentine plastered a drunken smile across his face, trying to live up to his role of eager sailor. The captain entered, nodding to someone. Valentine looked at Harper, and the two wolves exchanged shrugs. Silvertongue turned to the men.
Don't worry. We're going to frisk it for weapons and smokes. Just put your hands on the wall and read the sign.
A grog, roughly the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, barred their way. Over its yard-wide shoulder, Valentine watched the captain and then her mate being frisked and sniffed by a dog man right out of an H.G. Wells nightmare. When it finished with Silvertongue, the smelly roadblock at the door stepped aside and Valentine passed into the noise of the bunker. He mimicked Silvertongue's stance, placing his feet twice his shoulder width apart and putting his hands to either side of a sign, stenciled in paint onto another concrete wall just inside the door. To Valentine's left, a sumo-sized man sat inside a wire cage, idly scratching his stubble with a Saturday night submachine gun. As the dog man gave him the once-over, Valentine read the stenciled letters. The rules. Adolf's word is law. No smoking anything we didn't sell you. No drinking unless it's ours. You're only as good as your barter. You're only as bad as we let you be. Visit our gift shop. Confused? See Rule 1. Valentine retrieved his keg and joined the women. He looked around the bar, trying to avoid staring like a corn-fed hick fresh off the back 40. Electric light and noise overwhelmed him. Pre-recorded music played by machine was a rare treat to Valentine, and he gaped at the source. A box of neon and chrome against one cinder block wall blared CD selection and sound, as the reflective lettering on the glass proclaimed. A bar almost filled the wall opposite the jukebox, and a mismatched assortment of